Welcome to Counselor Audio Source. Counselor Audio Source is a regular podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at counselorAudioSource.net. I'm Dr. Marty Gentius from Kent State University, and this week in Counselor Audio Source, Sarah Moore with Dr. Clarice Rapisarda interviews Dr. Bob Barrett, Professor Emeritus, all from the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. Their topic is the 30-year career of Dr. Bob Barrett, counselor, counselor educator, father, grandfather, and gay man.
Well, hello, everybody. I have the pleasure today of being here with Dr. Bob Barrett, who is now Professor Emeritus from the Department of Counseling at UNC Charlotte, and with Ms. Sarah Moore, who is a doctoral candidate here in the Department of Counseling at UNC Charlotte. And today we will be hearing some interesting stories from Dr. Barrett, and Ms. Sarah will be kind of talking with him about his life and experiences as he's journeying down some very interesting paths. And so I'm going to turn things over to Sarah.
Good morning, Dr. Barrett.
Good morning.
I thought this would be a good time for us to reflect some on, now that you're at your retirement and moving into Professor Emeritus, on your experiences over the years while working in counseling, and also on your own personal experiences with a shift in sexual identity in midlife.
Okay. I'm happy to chat with you about this.
Well, thank you. I think you're a wonderful storyteller, and I wanted to give you a chance today to tell some stories about your experiences that will help students in the class as they're learning to become counselors in training, to talk about what has impacted you and what you feel like you have been able to offer to your clients and your students that might help them as they move into their careers as counselors or counselor educators.
Well, one of the things that I think is sort of fundamental as I reflect on my experience, any counselor who's going to be working with sexual minorities would benefit from a personal reflection as well to understand his or her values and beliefs and biases. All those things are there. And they certainly were there for me as I began to come to understand myself as a gay man. And the first step for me was to overcome all of that struggle about, am I okay if I'm a gay man? And what's going to happen in my work if I come out as a gay man? And a real turning point for me came, I had been doing first in the 80s work with cancer patients, and then when HIV came along with people with HIV. And actually, the American Psychological Association invited me to go up to Washington, D.C. to, as it turns out, audition to be on a training faculty. We were going to do 16 conferences around the country, training people to do clinical work with people who had HIV. And when I got there that morning, I had been married for, I guess, 26 years at that point, and came into this Holiday Inn meeting room. And as I had worked with these gay men who were suffering from HIV and got to know their caregivers, I had begun to realize that I was more like these gay men than I was about my straight male friends. And I wasn't quite sure what to do about that. It seemed like a huge shaking of my world if I were going to pursue that and come to understand myself more fully. But I was sitting in this Holiday Inn, and people started coming into the meeting room, and they'd come over and introduce themselves to me, and I had read their work, and I knew who they were, but had never met them. They didn't know who I was because I was just from North Carolina. So I was sitting there, and the meeting got going, and all of a sudden I realized most of these people in this room are gay men. And it was like I can be gay and still have a job. I mean, it seems silly today. And a professional organization is not afraid to have gay men and go around and do this work. They don't back away from that. It was really just a major shake for me. And I made friends with these guys and eventually became a part of that faculty. And that was when I really began to say, it's time for me to take myself more seriously and to examine this part of me and understand it more fully. And over the years, I had brought that up occasionally in therapy, and the therapist would say things like, oh, Bob, you're not gay. And I would go, phew, well, thank goodness I'm not gay. And how silly that was, but also what a disservice these counselors I had been talking to over the years had done to me. They shut me off before I could really start talking about it. And so I got into therapy, actually, with a guy, and he finally said to me, I don't think you're gay. And I said, you know, if you say that to me one more time, I'm going to get up and walk out of this room because I know more about me than you do. That was not a very successful counseling experience either. But trying to figure out how to sort all that out was difficult, how to sort it out in my personal life and in my professional life. And actually, one of the men who were on this faculty with me got in touch with me and said, Bob, you can't come out in Charlotte, North Carolina. It's too negative an environment. And why don't you come out here to San Francisco, and you can work with me. There's plenty of work to do. And you can live with me and my lover if you'd like to. And just do this in a much more positive environment. And so that's what I did. And it was a very positive environment. And after I'd been there about 6 months, I applied for a job at the medical school in a triage unit. And part of my interview was to declare myself as a gay man who's there doing this interview. And I had just decided, you know, that's the way this is going to be. I'm just going to say this. And I don't want to hide that part of myself any longer. And I got the job, and that was seen as an asset. And it was the beginning, I think, of my understanding that this part of me that had seemed so heinous and so shameful was really a gift. And it was a gift that was prized by other people, and that I had something to give out of this gift rather than just have to be loaded down with this burden I toted around all the time. And that interview, I think, really changed my life in a way of being able to stand up and say, this is who I am, and I'm not ashamed of this or afraid of this. And as a matter of fact, it's a part of me that allows me to offer more professionally and personally. So that was just a great movement. Of course, the challenge was then, am I going to come back to Charlotte or not? And I stayed out there 2 years. I was on leave from my job here at UNC Charlotte and supported in being on leave. And I finally decided I need to talk to my boss in Charlotte about what's going on. And so I met with her, and she's been a good friend and a mentor for me over the years. And I was in the process of coming out to my three daughters, and I was very shaken by doing that and afraid of what was going to happen. So I sat down with Mary Thomas Burke, and I began to explain what was happening. And I cried because I was afraid, and I was afraid to a certain extent of her response as well. And she was a great listener. And she sat across from me and she said, well, you know, Bob, if you're being who you are, that's really the main thing. But don't you tell anybody about this. And so I said, well, thank you, Mary Thomas, but you're not the first to know. And you know, I think I'd like to say everything was just a smooth road from that point on, and it wasn't. It's as it is not for most sexual minorities. The coming to understand yourself as a gay man or lesbian or bisexual or transgender is a process of a lot of pain, and there are a lot of walls that I bumped into, just like other people bump into, and I continue to bump into. But once I made the commitment to not back away, to sort of no longer pass as a straight person, then that sort of demanded from me that I declare this in appropriate situations. And not all of those situations went well. And I think that's generally true with what happens with most sexual minorities. They have a lot of successful and wonderful experiences and others that don't go quite so well. When I came back to Charlotte after 2 years in San Francisco, I realized that there was a lot of work I could do here. The medical school had put me on leave from my job there because they wanted me to come back, and they understood exactly why I was coming back here. So I was coming back to UNC Charlotte, where I was on leave, and leaving this position in San Francisco that I could go back to if I wanted to. And my intention was to go back. I was really motivated to return here because when I was in San Francisco, people would show up from Charlotte, and I'd go through this long story about myself, and I was so tired of telling it, and I decided I'm going to come back to Charlotte and face down the ghost of who I used to be and let people come to see me as the person I am now. And that was scary and exciting and absolutely something I was committed to. Figuring out how to do that wasn't so easy. So it wasn't too long after I'd been back here that the local newspaper just did an awful job. Every time they talked about a gay or lesbian person, they went and interviewed this fundamentalist preacher as if he knew everything about it. And he would rant and rave, and they would put that in the paper. So I wrote a letter to the editor, publisher of the paper, saying that as I read the paper, that I can see they don't understand who we are, and I would like to bring some people down to talk with the editors and help them come to see what the gay community was like. And he responded immediately, "That's a great idea. You'll be hearing from the editor." So the editor got in touch with me about 2 weeks later and said, "We'd like to invite you to come down, and how many people do you want to bring?" And I said, "Well, I think I could get 5 or 6. And he said, "Great," and set the date. Well, of course, then the problem was finding people who would do this because people were afraid. And eventually I collected this group of people, and we go down there. And when we go into the building, there's this signs around saying gay and lesbian panel, such and such a time at such and such a place. And, of course, a lot of the people didn't trust the media and were afraid, well, they're just going to write us up and expose us. And I was, even though I wanted to get out to everybody, I was worried about that, too. But we met in this room that was just filled with people. And it was probably one of the most important experiences of my life because we started talking. We introduced ourselves just as who we were and where we'd gone to school and what jobs we had. And it was like watching these very influential people begin to understand. And this one guy who's the current editor of our paper, Ed Williams, was sitting there and he goes, hold on a minute, wait a minute. And he was quiet for a second. He says, "This is not a moral issue. This is a civil rights issue." Right. And the editor of the paper walked me out and he said, "We are going to help you change this city. But you have to be in front of us. We can't be in front of you." And he later said to me in a subsequent meetings that I had with him, "Bob, you're such a reasonable person, and your reasonableness is a strength, but a little more unreasonableness might help." He wanted me to demand more and to be much more assertive. Well, we changed the city. I mean, they did, and that was very exciting. It also had implications on my teaching out here and in my clinical practice. I thought, well, if I get all the way out, are students going to take my classes? Will clients come to me? What's going to happen? And that first year back, after the meeting with the editors, we had a meeting with reporters, and this one reporter came to me and said, "I would like to interview you." And I said, "Well, let me get some people together." She said, "No, I want to interview you." And I said, "Well, maybe I can find..." She said, "Look, I want to interview you." So I thought, well, this is what I came here to do. So take a deep breath. And we did this interview. And there was a Sunday morning paper was going to have the interview with me. And I was thinking, oh, gosh, what have I done? This is going to be terrible. And before I could get to the paper, my phone rang. And a woman said, "Is this that Dr. Barrett that's in the paper today?" I said, "Yes, ma'am, I guess it is." And she said, "Well, let me tell you what you need to do." And I could see she was getting ready to get going. And I said, "You know, ma'am, what I need to do right now is not to listen to what you have to say. But thank you very much for calling." But that's kind of set me on edge for the day. But everywhere I went in Charlotte that day, to the hardware store, to Home Depot, to different places I would go, the checkout person would look at me sort of funny and say, "Are you that man that was in the paper this morning?" And I'd say, "Well, I sure am." And what I got back was just about universally the same. "I am so glad you're here." It was just this enormous sense of acceptance and celebration, really. And after that, I realized this is going to be okay. I probably got 4 or 5 threatening letters. "I'm going to come get you." One of them ended with, "If you're not careful, Satan is going to get you." So it was great fun. But then there were hundreds of letters and emails from all over the South, from closeted gay men and parents of gay and lesbian children, to saying how important this was and how grateful they were that I had done the interview.
I'm thinking about the impact that this has had on your life and how that has allowed you to be a better counselor to your gay and lesbian clients, but also a better teacher to students who want to work with that population.
Well, on my personal life, of course, it's been, it's had its challenges. I have 3 daughters, and they were all, the youngest was 18 when I came out, and she was away from the family at that time. And the 2 youngest daughters are fundamental Christians, and I can't quite explain how that happened, but it happened. And there's a big struggle. And the struggle is, I don't think it'll ever completely end, because while they'll say that my being gay is sinful and that they are also sinners, they don't exclude me. They want me to be part of their families, but they certainly don't want to hear anything about my gay life, and they don't want their children to know anything about my gay life, as if my gay life were some scandal, when it's pretty boring most of the time. So that's been troublesome, and their flare-ups, and so that's been some bumps there. In my family, my 2 brothers and my mother, for the longest time, my mother would send me what I called grenade letters. I never knew whether when I opened the letter it was just going to blow all over me, or whether it would be her effort to be more accepting and understanding. So, but I just decided I'm just going to stand right here and keep doing what I'm doing. And one of the things I did professionally in that first year back, and in 1991, gay and lesbian people gathered in bars, and that had historically been the place for them to gather. And it's no accident that there is a fair amount of alcoholism and substance use issue in the gay and lesbian community, because that was the only place they could gather. So I decided that I wanted to see if we could get a different kind of gathering. So I went to an Episcopal church and talked to the minister and said, "I want to get a discussion group going, and we need a room. And we need it once a month for 2 hours. So I started this discussion thing called Queer Conversations. And it was open to anybody who wanted to come, and we would sit in a circle, and there would be one topic of conversation, and I figured there might be 12 people. Well, by the second month, there were 50. So orchestrating this conversation with these 50 people was challenging. But obviously that showed me the level of need for a real conversation, not in a sexually charged atmosphere or an alcohol-charged atmosphere, was great. And that group went for about 2.5 years before it ended. Most of the conversation in the group, regardless of the topic that was selected to talk about, came back to this coming out stuff. And that's really about coming out is not a point in time. Coming out is an ongoing experience. And there are really 2 levels of that. There's telling the news, and then there's teaching about the community. So the people who just say it and then never bring it up again have really failed to educate their own community about what this means and who they are. So my work, sort of advocate work, was to try to get people to learn how to do the teaching piece, to talk about themselves and to normalize their experience. And I think it, all of that, the advocacy, the clinical work, the teaching, my personal life, were all coming together to help me understand the experience of a lot of people. And there's not one experience. There's so many experiences. But the struggle is, how can I live more comfortably and lovingly with myself? That's really the first step. And beyond that is, so how far am I going to go in this coming out process? And there certainly were many times that I have worried that I am putting pressure on my clients to go further than they're ready to go. My belief, and the research backs this up, is the more out the person is, the greater degree they are living a healthy, mentally healthy life. So believing that, I have to watch myself to not be subtly encouraging them to do things they're not ready to do, and to sort of accept them where they are. But as a gay male and as a counselor, I often find myself just wishing this person could get up, take the next step. There's a guy in my practice now, I've been seeing him for 3 years. And in this three-year period, just last week, he finally went to a gay bar. He has no gay friends. And he'd say, well, I'm a gay man, blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, you don't have a clue what being a gay man is, because you're in this solitary, closeted life. And so if I can get you somehow to begin to enter the gay community, a place where you're comfortable, then your identity can develop. So he did that, and that turned out successful for him. And he says he'll go back, and I hope that does happen. But people move at their own pace, and sometimes staying with these people who are moving like a turtle is not easy. But that's what they need. They just need you to be there with them and let them work it out over time.
As you look back over your career now that you're retiring, I wonder what you think were the most impactful things that you've learned that would be helpful to clinicians and counselor educators as they work with clients in general, but especially with the GLBT population?
Well, I think the first thing, which is what I did, which was to throw myself in a very active and exciting gay community in going to San Francisco that was so broad and had so much going on in it. So I think first for the counselor who's wanting to work with this population would be to enter the community. There are all kinds of events in most large metropolitan areas. There's generally a gay and lesbian chorus that puts on performances. There's a gay pride, either a march or a celebration. There are gay and lesbian churches. So the opportunities are pretty much endless. And there is this national webpage, gay.com. And usually at gay.com, you can go to your local community, and it take you to a web page that will have the resources of what's going on in your local community. And I think not just looking at that and reading to see what's there, but actually going and participating in some of this and seeing for yourself what's going on, so that when you recommend that a person go search this out, you have an idea of, well, this is what they're going to find when they get there. Some of the resources are not the best ones. They'll be listed, but they might not necessarily be the best places for people to go. In Charlotte, there's been a psychologist who runs a support group for married gay men. Well, I went and spoke to them once, and I was just sort of appalled at really what was going on there. Was a whole lot of men making sexual contact with other married gay men, and it wasn't a real healthy environment. And if I had recommended someone go there, I don't think that would have been a helpful recommendation to make. So I think it's about, as I said in the very beginning, learning your own attitudes and then becoming aware of what is here in the community, and then begin to start seeing those gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender clients as teachers. And certainly it's appropriate to acknowledge that you don't know as much as you'd like to know about their experience, and get them to tell you about their experience and listen to it. It would be, I think, a very great disservice to start counseling someone in an area that you don't really understand and not ask them, well, help me understand that better. Tell me about that part of the community you live in. So I think those are really important things to do. I also think it's important for the counselor to be prepared for things not to always go well. I had been working with a guy who was coming out to his parents. He had been a youth minister at a church, and his church life was really important. And we worked on how he was going to do this and when he was going to do it. So he goes to do it. And his mother's immediate response was, I would rather have you laying here in a coffin than having heard what you just told me. And if you don't quit your job tomorrow, I'm going to call that preacher up at that church and have him fire you. Well, we really planned that pretty carefully. But that kind of response, I mean, we talked about what was the worst, and he was prepared to give up his family. But the hurtfulness of those words, I don't think there's any way to prepare for that. And I think we have to look at, well, what's the worst thing that could happen here? But there's no way as a counselor I don't know these parents, I can't really help them be prepared for some of those very mean and cruel statements. So it took us some weeks for him to get over that, and he just hung in there and hung in. He went and quit his job the next day. And that created a crisis for him, of course, that we hadn't anticipated, but he made it through somehow. And I think there's so many avenues that are out there for people to think there's only one way is a setup, and being prepared to look at, well, what are the alternatives out here, what might happen, and how are you going to deal with that as best you can, but also be prepared for the unexpected. I think that's really important. One other thing that I think is critical is to develop an appreciation for the richness and the creativity that is in the gay and lesbian community. We hear so often, and particularly in the political level, about protecting heterosexual marriage, and as if these gay men and lesbians and bisexuals were going to destroy the institution of marriage. And if you look at the way gay and lesbian relationships function, mostly without the support of a larger community, without the support of certain legal protections, I think there's a lot that these people have to teach us about how to create and maintain a relationship. And there's a kind of richness there, and certainly a demand to be creative there, that I think straight people don't have to encounter. They can encounter that, but it's easy to go get married, and well, that's that, and everybody in the family's happy, and you just go off and start your life. But the kinds of things that gay men and lesbians have to do to maintain their relationships and figure out, are we both going to be out to our families, and how are the families going to deal with us, and how do we deal with them, and how do we declare this relationship at work, or do we hide it at work? I mean, there's so many questions that go there. And, you know, there are a whole lot of really, really healthy people who answer those questions and figure out their way and flourish.
Okay, yeah, I wanted to give you a chance to, as you think back over your career, to talk maybe a few minutes about what you feel like has been the most impactful for you and what you really have been able to contribute the most to the counseling profession.
Well, I've been here at the university for 29 years, and the most impactful thing, I think, is not really just about sexual minorities, it's about all people, and it's how do you just be who you are, and learning that who you are is sufficient, even additive to a community in surprising ways, and that challenge, I think, to just live out yourself with the most integrity you can is a challenge that faces all people. But it's particularly with sexual minorities, it's particularly challenging because, unlike other minority groups, there's often not family support. That this announcement is not going to be greeted by most families with a celebration. And so there's a unique quality to it that takes a particular kind of strength and courage and belief in yourself for a person to take these steps. Still, the most securing way to ground your life is just to be who you are. and to not live in fear, and to recognize that if I can just be who I am respectfully, I'll be okay in the world. And that doesn't mean not challenged, but okay.
I want to thank you for doing the interview today, and just tell you how honored I am to know you, and that I really respect all that you've done for the GLB community, but also for the counseling profession.
Thank you very much, Sarah.
As you move into retirement. Thank you.
All right. This is Dr. Aprisarda, and I want to extend my thanks to both Dr. Barrett and Sarah for being with us today as we discussed all of these different things. Dr. Barrett, truly Charlotte would not be the place it is now were it not for your gift of yourself and being, I loved how you worded that, being secured in yourself so that you could be okay with how things are.
Thank you.
So thank you very much, both of you.
You've just heard an interview of Dr. Bob Barrett regarding his life and 30-year career. Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback at the podcast website, counselaraudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments for guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source. Counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is More Red Than Red by Derek K. Miller. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering flexible copyright for creative work.